And our sermon text today is Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verses 1 through 9. Who is like the wise, and who knows the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the hardness of his face is changed. I say, keep the king's command because of God's oath to him. Be not hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand in an evil cause, for he does whatever he pleases. For the word of the king is supreme, and who may say to him, what are you doing? Whoever keeps a command will know no evil thing, and the wise heart will know the proper time and the just way. For there is a time and a way for everything, although man's trouble lies heavy on him. For he does not know what is to be, for who can tell him how it will be? No man has power to retain the spirit or power over the day of death. There is no discharge from war, nor will wickedness deliver those who are given to it. All this I observe while applying my heart to all that is done under the sun, when man had power over man to his hurt. One of my favorite characters from World War II is General George Patton, for a number of reasons. Although the title of our sermon today was not one of them, he was not a very discreet man. He was brave, smart, aggressive, one of the best tactical commanders the U.S. Army ever had. And he demonstrated this with his command in Italy, at Sicily and Messina, where he showed courage, imagination, great skill in swiftly defeating forces larger than his own. But he was also loud, proud, and unable to hold his tongue. In one famous incident, he slapped a soldier who was in hospital for what we would now diagnose as battle fatigue. He cursed at him, threw him out of the hospital tent, and told him he was going back to the front. Was this a wise move, since he was being followed around by a flock of reporters? It made headlines at home and hurt him with the moms and dads who had sons in similar circumstances. This is representative of his short temper, his long diatribes that question not only the lineage and paternity of his enemies, but the wisdom of some of his decisions by his superiors, some of the decisions by his superiors. When the Allies planned the invasion of D-Day in Europe, FDR and General George Marshall and Winston Churchill considered many names, including General George Patton. But all soon agreed that the volatile Patton, who had a continuing simmering feud with the British commander Montgomery, would soon polarize the command and be unable to manage the strong personalities of Omar Bradley and Montgomery, Churchill, Charles de Gaulle. So on one of the best command decisions of the war, they decided upon General Dwight David Eisenhower to be Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces. And what they did with Patton was both brilliant and a bit of sweet irony, too. They put him in command of a dummy, fictitious army in the south of England in Operation Quicksilver. It was meant to fool the Germans into thinking that the real invasion of Europe would come at the shortest crossing point in the English Channel between the Straits of Dover in England and Pas-de-Calais in France. Consequently, the Germans concentrated most of their forces there and built up the dense impenetrable defenses in the harbor. But of course, the real invasion would come at the more sparsely defended Normandy beachhead, as it did on June 6, 1944. But the selection of Patton to lead the dummy army was a deft, two-edged sword. On the one hand, if the ruse was to have any credibility, it must be led by the general the Germans feared the most, Patton. They had their fill of him in Italy, and they wanted no more of him. On the other hand, it kept the stormy, impertinent Patton from sabotaging the plans for the real invasion at Normandy. Historians generally agree that Eisenhower was the perfect man for the job and Patton would have been the worst. But you can imagine how the impetuous Patton felt about his new command. He had visions of himself as the American Alexander the Great, who would lead armies across Europe to Berlin and beyond. He wanted to march on to Moscow after the war was over, to then be given command of rubber tanks and wooden guns and a dummy army. It was pretty humiliating. And it's not fit to print what he said to General Omar Bradley when he was told of his command. But of course, Patton would go on to lead one of the most important actions of World War II, too. That is, his bold and daring relief of the siege of Bastogne during the Battle of the Bulge. Who knows what sort of leader he would have made with a little more of the character trait exhorted upon us here in our text today, discretion. Discretion. His counterpart, General Eisenhower, went on to become President of the United States. Right? Well, that is our title today. And it is one of the themes that runs through here consistently in our text. And I have three points that I want to make with you. I don't think one of those points made it to your bulletin, if I'm not mistaken. Are there 2 points? There are three? Oh, good. Good. All right. Well, then we proceed. Point number one from verse one, discretion. The discreet man employs his gifts to their maximum when called upon, knowing their salutary effects. From verse 1. Our setting today, we gather, is the court of the king and those who advise him. And our text begins with a proverb on the efficacy of wisdom in the life of a king's court. Who is like the wise? And who knows the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the hardness of his face is changed. One of the benefits of wisdom exercised in a king's court. Now, the essence of Hebrew poetry is parallelism. We've discussed this many times in other contexts, especially in Sunday school. That is, you have two lines that reprise or advance a single thought. Hebrew rhymes thought rather than words. And we have that here. We have a rhetorical question that asks, who is like the wise? Implicit there is no one, really. And who knows the interpretation of a thing? That word interpretation, a good translation. I like whoever was on the committee to translate for the ESV, this book, Ecclesiastes, because they do a good job. Who knows the interpretation? Rather than the NIV has explanation. That's a little insipid, really. So, who knows the interpretation of a thing? And the second line in this case advances the previous line, filling in the meaning or the essence of wisdom, that is, given from God to interpret the world around him. What do you think a man would give for such an advisor, huh? I only wish our leaders sought for such advisors. Especially if that king or that president had great responsibility over many people. So remember, the context of Ecclesiastes, we have seen the purpose, first purpose for this is to indeed educate and train Solomon's sons as they would be ruling over the people of Israel after him. Consider the weighty and perplexing problems that such men face who lead others. For example, should I, Rehoboam, of course, one of Solomon's sons, should I, Rehoboam, follow in the footsteps of my father Solomon and rule firmly but fairly, or increase their burden? Huh. Or should I, Solomon, arbitrarily assign this baby to one of these two prostitutes, or is there some other way of discerning who is the true mother? Or another advisor that we find in the Old Testament, should I, Daniel, fall prey to the schemes of my enemies, which he could see through right away, and pray to Darius the king for 30 days? Or pray to the only true God, the true lion of the tribe of Judah, Yahweh Elohim? Who is like the wise? And who knows the interpretation of a thing? Would each of these men, what they would have given for a true, godly, wise advisor or godly wisdom themselves, some of whom did, of course, or an advisor with it. In our own day, should we, President Biden and Harris, persist in our present course with the economy, knowing our policies have been a complete failure, making things worse and not better, or listen to other wisdom and change course? Should we, Biden and Harris, persist in our present course in the Ukraine, enabling that lounge lizard Zelensky? Did you know that he was a lounge lizard? He played piano and so forth and sang songs before he was elected president. Anyway, enabling this lounge lizard Zelensky to acquire nuclear weapons to threaten Putin and Russia, risking World War III? Or should we find wise advisors? Should we, Biden and Harris, persist in our present course of pretending there is no southern border, facilitating the treasonous invasion of millions of unvetted illegal aliens? What would this man give for true, this administration, for true godly wisdom, or advisors with it? They certainly have none of this now. Have you noticed how senile and doddering and pathetic our president has become? How empty and vacuous his countenance? Every time I see him, I think of this text recently, the hardness of his face. The problems of the world are precisely as Koheleth describes them for us. I said, I will be wise, back in chapter 7. I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which has been is far off and deep, very deep. Who can find it? Those problems persist and always seem to escape solution to some. Where is peace for all men? Where is justice for all men? Where is prosperity and abundance for all men? When you finally attain that rarefied air of absolute power, you finally grasp that brass ring of the accolades and opportunity of all the people, when you finally lay your hands on the levers of power in America, what do you find? You find out that you're not Messiah, after all. You find that you cannot simply translate your will and wishes into reality at the wave of your hand and stroke of a pen. You find that despite your own self-flattering portrait as that of a deliverer, you've only managed to deliver disappointment and failure, and that perhaps Domino's Pizza can deliver far better than you. All of this makes for hardness of face. That's the sense of that Hebrew idiom, hardness of face. Oh, for wisdom that changes that expression. And who can provide it? How do you think the expressions on the faces of these men change when advised by men of true biblical wisdom? This proposal that we read about in the reading of the law, this proposal of Joseph, pleased Pharaoh and all of his servants. His hardness of face changed. Remember, all of his advisors couldn't interpret that dream. And Pharaoh said to all of his servants, "Can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God?" Or Daniel said to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouths." You remember his response. The king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. That hardness of face changed with the wisdom and character of Daniel. Or Nathan. Nathan said to David, "You are the man. You have struck down Uriah the Hittite and have taken his wife." And David says to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." How do you think this changed the hardness of face of David and his guilt over his sin with Bathsheba, or even the hardness of face of Nathan, huh? Well, I guarantee you that the change of face noted here by Koheleth was experienced by Pharaoh and Darius and David and Nathan. Their faces shined. The interpretation of the thing offered by each of the godly wise was spot on. Joseph, Daniel, and Nathan were the wise ones sent by God to cut the Gordian knot, to slice through the bull, to make the face shine. That is to smile, rejoice, celebrate over a true answer. Such is the proverb that opens this section. And that brings us to point two. Verses 2-5. The discreet man employs his gifts with restraint when under command, knowing his limited perspective. The discreet man employs his gifts with restraint when under command, knowing his limited perspective. Koheleth now goes on to compactly describe the courtier's role in advising the king. Give it your best shot and then shut up and await the outcome. God will vindicate you. That's the summary of these verses, much more eloquently put, though. My point encompasses verses 2-5, which in turn comprises a chiasm, as it's called, that is, parallel points, which can be plotted on a type of graph. First of all, in common, verses 2 and verses 5 are parallel. In common, they have the keeping of the king's command. Whosoever keeps a command, keep the king's command, right? They both advance the wisdom of doing so, both for the advisor who does and the advantage to the king and his people. A wise man should keep the king's command because of God's oath to him, that is, to the king. You observe the footnote, right, in your text? Your Bibles should all have a footnote there in your text, all worthy translations anyway. There's a very close option to take, an objective or subjective genitive. I'm going to get in the weeds here a little bit, but we'll get into the weeds a little bit in our Greek for layman class too, so be prepared to do this as well. Well, in brief, the text before us, the Hebrew could be rendered as an objective genitive, that is, it would be translated as your oath to God. That is an oath that a king or subject would make to God. And as such, one would keep the king's orders or will expressed as policy because of one's commitment to the word sworn unto God. Or it could be what is called a subjective genitive. Thus, it would be translated as God's oath to him. That is, an oath that God made unto the king. And as such, one would keep the king's orders or will express his policy because of God's commitment to the king expressed in a promise or covenant. It is this last sense in which I take this translation. It is a subjective genitive, if you will, translated precisely as our interpretation, the ESV, renders it. Why? because of the motif of God's covenant with David. I will raise up for you offspring after you. I will establish his kingdom forever. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. From 2 Samuel chapter 7. God gave an oath to David to establish his kingdom forever. The king who sat upon the throne was his true descendant. He was, in every respect, the Lord's anointed. And as we observed in our Old Testament reading today, David was loath to raise his hand against his bitter sworn enemy Saul, precisely because Saul was nevertheless the Lord's anointed. So, must he keep the king's command? So must he keep the king's command. In either case, there is an implied threat here too, whether it be the oath to the king or God's oath to him. The word of the king is supreme, even as Eisenhower was the supreme commander of Allied forces on D-Day. Well, the following verse, verse 3b, do not speak hastily in the king's presence, is paralleled by who will say, what are you doing, right? Parallel thoughts there as well. And this following verse is a euphemism for how we've rendered it. Be not hasty to go from his presence. That is to excuse oneself in dismissal. Or do not speak hastily in the king's presence too. That is to excuse oneself. Make excuses for oneself, that is. And it's related to verse 4. Who may say to him, what are you doing? Right? Both are unwise responses. Both caution against rash speech and presumptive, impertinent advice in the presence of the king when one is unaware or ill-informed. The ESV renders it accurately. What are you doing? What are you doing? We hear this rash impertinence in other places too. We hear it echoed in the voices of Darius's advisors. O king, did you not sign an injunction that anyone who makes petition to any god or man within 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? You can hear the tone. What are you doing? We hear it in the tone of the Jews before Pontius Pilate. If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. We have no king but Caesar. You can hear the, what are you doing, Pontius Pilate? Both of these embody the very essence of Solomon's caution. Do not take your stand in an evil cause. All of this sounds very much like the voice of experience in Solomon's own life at court, doesn't it? How often do you think he heard this from his own advisors, right? Elders, tribal chiefs, any of you who have authority in your jobs, at work, you've experienced this, even if in the life of the church. What are you doing? What in the world is the session doing with this decision, whatever it might be, right? How many different ways can you say this? How many different ways have you heard it? What are you doing? 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 A lot of different ways you can say it, right? A lot of different ways I've heard it, too. It captures in one expression the tendency in the human heart to question the judgment and wisdom of anyone in authority. As a young believer, I questioned the judgment of the deacons of the Baptist church that I attended. We had a food pantry from which we supplied the needs of our congregation and the needs of our community. And one of the requirements the deacons laid upon petitioners for our food or assistance of any kind is that they attend worship services of the church. I thought this was unnecessarily strict, quite non-compassionate. After all, Jesus didn't require that all those 500,000 or those 5,000 people attend synagogue service, or those to whom he gave a cup of cold water, right? Can you hear? What are you doing? There was that in my attitude, anyway. But of course, later I discovered that there are those in that community and in our community, for that matter, too. Our deacons know this and the elders know it, too. Who systematically eked out a living by cynically making a case of need to local churches, getting money and food and other resources, and they could move on to easier prey by ignoring the requirements of churches like us. But at that time, I had neither the wisdom, the experience, nor all the information to make a sound judgment. But that didn't stop me from asking, what are you doing? Right? Since being a pastor and participating in the decisions made by session, I have a great deal more sympathy for those deacons. We often have information, too, as a session. We often have information the congregation or presbytery is not privy to, nor should they be. And hopefully, we have a measure of godly wisdom and experience that lead us to sound decisions. This is why Reformed and Presbyterian congregations elect elders, and why, after having done so, those congregations should trust the decisions made by those bodies and not exclaim, "What are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing?" But there's a caveat here, too. That is, that doesn't mean you cannot respectfully ask questions or even challenge a decision if there's something egregiously illegal, immoral, or unjust. Well, the caution put before us by Koheleth is against my previous attitude. That is, impertinent, arrogant, and presumptive questioning of a ruling body's or ruler's wisdom and judgment in making a decision. The prudent man will be discreet in his judgments when he's not privy to all the information and the course taken by leaders in making decisions. General Patton surely wasn't privy to the counsels of FDR, Churchill, and General Marshall when they appointed the judicious, discreet Eisenhower as Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces. Nor when Eisenhower and Bradley made Patton commander of a cardboard and rubber army. He chafed, he complained privately, he flirted with insubordination on several occasions, but in the end, Operation Quicksilver is considered one of the most stupendous successes in military history. They had all read their Sun Tzu. His principle is that clever deception is worth a company of soldiers. And that's precisely what he did in diverting all those troops to Pas-de-Calais instead of Normandy. Well, Koheleth's advice to those of us who must live with decisions we may not like nor agree. What is his advice? He says, the wise heart will know the proper time and the just way. The wise heart will know the proper time and the just way. That brings us to point 3, verses 6 through 9. The discreet man employs his gifts with humility while serving the king, knowing that timing is everything. Verses 6 through 9, we've dealt with this before, haven't we? Chapter 3. Once again, these themes recur, do they not? Cyclically, but they advance every time they do. The discreet man employs his gift with humility while serving the king, knowing that timing is everything. Koheleth comes round to this motif. For everything there is a season, a time for every matter under heaven, right? From chapter 3, verse 1. Here he says, there is a time and a way for everything. Ding, 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 right? Our bell should be going off. The wise man knows the apt time to do a thing. And he also knows the fit method for doing it. He knows, for example, from everyday life, he knows the time to hit the nail is not when his thumb is on the head centering the nail and he doesn't drive a picture hanging nail with a sledgehammer. He knows the time to say, be careful on the black ice, honey, to his wife is not when she is on her back in her leather heels that you bought her. He knows the time to say, use the red pump head, not the green pump head, to his young son filling the gas tank for the first time. It's not after he's just filled up the family Buick with diesel fuel. No. There's an apt time and a fit method for doing a thing. And the wise counselor, the wise king, knows the apt time and the fit method. The time to say, oops, there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, is not after you've committed the 4th Infantry Division to Baghdad, right? But before then. Remember that from history. Or, it's still pertinent today, we should stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. It's not after a mushroom cloud blossoms over Tel Aviv or Washington, D.C., but before then, with a judicious use of military and non-military methods. That's going to be prominent in the year to come, brothers and sisters, or in Ukraine. It's apt that we prayed today for our country, for our nation. While we see the same wisdom and the same foolishness in the marketplace of our daily lives too, don't we? We've all experienced this to some degree or another. The foolish boss who chews out a subordinate in front of the very people he expects the subordinate to command. Huh? The wise boss takes his subordinate aside in private and corrects him. He does it in the manner that he knows will be best for improving his performance. Or the foolish engineer who tells his superiors, this system will not bear the stresses to which you are subjecting it, after radioactive material is spewing in the atmosphere, right? Knowing full well that this was the state of things beforehand. The wise engineer who follows the chain of command, puts everything in writing, and alerts his peers to every contingency is the wise engineer. Or the foolish employee who criticizes management at every opportunity around the water cooler, lunchroom, in the parking lot. You don't get paid to complain, do you? The wise employee uses proper channels, chain of command, to make intelligent, helpful corrections and suggestions for improved performance. The same goes for life in the church. Do you know how to deal wisely with your session and with your pastor, dear congregant? Or, conversely, does your pastor know how to deal wisely with his officers and with the flock? Oh, I look at myself in the mirror every morning and ask that question. Well, the wise man does all of these things in keeping with our motif from last week. A man has got to know his limitations, right? From Dirty Harry. Best advice, some of the best advice in our culture. A man has got to know his limitations. He does not know what is to be, after all. Does he, as our text says? He does not know what is to be. In this election cycle, how many of our leaders presume to know or think that they can determine the outcome of an election through schemes and cheating and manipulating the public, huh? No man has power to retain the spirit at death either. Who has power over death in the end, right? The wise acknowledge God's providence. Ray Kurzweil speculates that we have AI systems now so advanced that the elite soon will be able to upload their brainwaves, their personality, their voice, their life patterns, such that they attain a kind of eternal life. Important qualification. A kind of eternal life. A lost and fallen eternal life. Huh? No man has power to retain the spirit or mastery over the day of death. The wise acknowledge God's providence. There is no discharge from war either. There is no discharge from war. This is a direct allusion to the Pentateuch's provision for a man to be discharged If he is just married or he's built a new house, there are several circumstances under which a man can be discharged from war. And Koheleth is saying, now that you've asked for a king, no way. There is no discharge from war. War touches everyone in our own day, doesn't it? With impact. This is especially true now with nuclear weapons and why our policy in Ukraine is so foolish. Elites are building deep earth bunkers, brothers and sisters. Have you set aside something in your budget for deep earth bunkers? Because the elites are doing this. Mark Zuckerberg, creator of Facebook, is building one to escape nuclear holocaust. They know it's coming, and some even say they're bringing it to pass. No man is discharged from the war, nor will wickedness deliver those who are given to it. Nor will wickedness, some think indeed that Satan is their deliverer. They have made a pact, a covenant with death, Isaiah calls it. And they think that in the day of the whip, they will avoid the chastisement. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven, right? As the poem has it, and so many believe and think and behave now. Well, here in these vignettes, Solomon is subtly pointing to the one who reigns above the sun. The wise acknowledge God's providence. He is alluding to the sovereign God who holds all things in his hand. He will dispose and dispense the destiny of his creatures in his own providential time. That's the ultimate in aptness. And in his own ways, which is the ultimate in mode and method, God's way. The wise man will realize this, doing that which is within his power. A man has to know his limitations and await the deliverance of the Lord. While the people eagerly anticipated Solomon to be the promised king who would reign perpetually, and as long as he ruled in the wisdom of God and under the hand of God humbly, they did experience this, did they not? A blessed time under his reign until he fell. They eagerly anticipated Solomon to be the promised king who would reign perpetually from the throne of David. Koheleth humbly realizes, by the time he composes Ecclesiastes, we have seen that it was indeed composed later in his life. He humbly realizes by this time he's not the man. He's but a sinner in need of salvation himself. He's fallen prey to horses and women. And it was left to another, a true son of David, not Solomon's direct descendants, to know the times and seasons, the apt day of silence as a lamb to the slaughter, the apt day of proclamation. I heard a loud voice from the throne say, behold, the dwelling place of God is now with man. Who also knows the apt day of submission to his father and the apt day of power. Worthy are you to take the scroll and open its seals, for you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. And you have made them a kings and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth. Brothers and sisters, this is a declaration of the present rule of the king that all the Old Testament saints eagerly searched for in the scriptures, ransacked the lives of Solomon and the kings to discover, is this the one? Is this the one? But this one has now taken the scroll. That is the covenant deed to his kingdom. He has opened it, and he now rules and is conquering, even now as we speak. In the service of worship, he has taken a little more ground. So, this would be an apt time to come to him, brothers and sisters. Those of you who have not, perhaps, and maybe do not know him, you can know him. And this would be an apt time for you to come to him and make a profession of faith before this congregation. That would be a proper method, too, as the wise man knows. Well, brothers and sisters, this is also an apt covenant moment to share a communion meal with him and with each other in the bread and wine, a proper method for doing so. So let us now come then to our Lord Jesus Christ in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.